to live without. If an incident like the Tsarnaev brothers blowing up two pressure cookers filled with shrapnel occurred, or if we uncovered another active plot, we used Section 215 authorities to quickly check if further attacks were imminent. We should have just explained that. We had had serious discussions of whether the metadata storage program governed by Section 215 was even an intelligence database, since it really functioned as a reference to confirm or refute a potential domestic terrorist nexus, a need identified by the 9/11 Commission. It might have been more appropriate for the database to be held by the FBI or DHS rather than NSA. Regardless, the upshot of declassifying the Section 215 program, for me personally, was that I was able to send a letter to Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Chairman Feinstein. That letter explained that during the unclassified hearing 3 months earlier, when questioned by Senator Wyden, I was thinking only about the unclassified FISA Section 702 program when I'd answered, and not about the then-classified Patriot Act Section 215 program. Our declassification of the 215 program finally allowed me to correct the record. As I wrote, I have appeared before congressional hearings and briefings dozens of times and have answered thousands of questions either orally or in writing. I take all such appearances seriously and prepare rigorously for them. But mistakes will happen, and when I make one, I correct it. My letter did nothing to change the public discussion about me, but it felt good to admit publicly to a mistake I'd made publicly. I'm not sure anyone noticed. As I was sending that letter, all eyes and all cameras were again focused on Hong Kong. After bringing charges against Snowden, the U.S. government had suspended his passport, which should have prevented him from leaving the city. However, on June 23rd, Hong Kong authorities allowed him, accompanied by Sarah Harrison, to board a flight to Moscow. His plan was to eventually get to Ecuador, the same nation that was protecting Julian Assange in its London embassy. China waited until the flight had cleared its airspace to announce that Snowden had left. Hong Kong authorities said that the United States had made a mistake with paperwork, one that invalidated our invalidation of Snowden's passport. I suspect China and its new president, Xi Jinping, were happy for any excuse to remove themselves from this awkward diplomatic situation. Vladimir Putin held a different worldview. For him, Snowden's arrival was an opportunity to slowly torment his old adversary, the United States, one that could be available to him for as long as he desired. So the Russian government officially recognized the U.S. revocation of Snowden's passport and refused to let him board a transfer flight. Snowden and Harrison were left stranded in the Moscow airport, unable to pass through customs into Russia and not permitted to board a flight to anywhere else. A group of journalists who either didn't know or didn't believe Moscow was keeping Snowden from traveling figured out that the next leg of his planned trip to Ecuador would be a flight to Havana the following morning, June 24th. They bought all the remaining tickets for the flight and boarded with cameras and notepads, ready to capture the story of a lifetime. When the plane left without Snowden, the journalists took turns tweeting pictures of his empty seat. For the next 40 days, Snowden and Harrison lived and slept in the no-man's land of the Moscow airport, unable to leave or enter Russia, as the world's diplomats decided their fate. On Tuesday, June 25th, Secretary of State John Kerry asked the Russian government to extradite Snowden. On Wednesday, Putin refused. Under pressure from the United States, the government of Ecuador revoked its offer of safe passage and asylum. A host of other nations followed suit, and many more skirted the issue by declaring that he'd have to be present on their soil before they'd consider the matter. On July 3rd, based on a false tip that Bolivian President Evo Morales was smuggling Snowden out of Moscow, France, Spain, and Portugal refused to let his plane transit their airspace. It landed in Vienna, where it was held overnight for a fruitless and embarrassing 12-hour search. Several Latin American nations showed their displeasure at this insult by offering Snowden asylum. He instead requested asylum in Russia. Putin responded that before he'd grant it, Snowden would have to stop harming American interests. I got the feeling Putin was really enjoying this. Snowden rescinded his appeal. On July 8th, The Guardian posted more of Poitras's interview with him, during which he predicted that the U.S. government would say, "I have committed grave crimes. I have violated the Espionage Act. They are going to say I have aided our enemies." Finally, on August 1st, Snowden was granted temporary asylum in Russia. He walked out of the airport and into his new life in Moscow. The media was reporting the leaks had continued during Snowden's time at the airport. The Guardian and the Washington Post published stories claiming, among other things, that the U.S. government had bugged the offices of the European Union in New York, Washington, and Brussels, that we were spying on 38 foreign embassies, and that we were reading millions of emails and text messages of innocent German citizens, at which point the German magazine Der Spiegel joined in printing the leaks. Together, the three media outlets released stories claiming the United States was spying on the innocent citizens of Brazil, Venezuela, Colombia, Argentina, Panama, Ecuador, and Peru. On July 10th, the Washington Post published what was purported to be an NSA graphic showing how the agency gained physical access to fiber optic cables. I couldn't fathom how this supposed revelation could benefit anyone except adversarial intelligence services. Other stories claimed the intelligence services of Australia, New Zealand, and Germany were complicit in the U.S. crimes, and that the United States paid GCHQ in the United Kingdom to conduct activities that were illegal under U.S. law. On July 20th, when U.K. authorities came to the Guardian offices with a warrant to seize the electronics given to them by Edward Snowden, the paper dramatically destroyed all of its equipment, saying they had copies of all the files safely somewhere outside the U.K. I spent a great deal of time in classified briefings on Capitol Hill and on secure phone lines with my foreign counterparts, refuting many of these claims from the leaks, while Stephanie O'Sullivan continued to focus on the IC workforce. At an event largely attended by IC employees, Stephanie captured what we were all feeling about Snowden. It's been clear that neither he nor the reporters he gave these to understood what they were looking at. A story earlier this month claimed that we had collected 70 million French telephone calls in a month. Those 70 million calls were in fact collected by the French intelligence service outside of France, in furtherance of mutual counterterrorism and force protection concerns, and provided by the French intelligence service to us. But until the truth was leaked to the Wall Street Journal, we couldn't correct this publicly because we'd damage sensitive intelligence relationships. That's the kind of problem we face. Most of the stories that have sprung from the leaks have focused on our considerable raw technical capabilities. They lay out our sources and methods, and what the Washington Post reports, Al-Qaeda knows. It's gotten to the point where I pick up the paper in the morning and I read an article with details that would have horrified me 8 months ago. And now I think, well, this isn't so bad. By the end of June, we decided we would respond to the leaks as an integrated community, much as we'd responded to the first round of budget cuts. In doing so, we would add a new word to the intelligence community lexicon: transparency. As someone who had been in or around the intelligence business for the better part of 7 decades, transparency felt genetically antithetical to me. But we knew we couldn't continue to counter the narrative just by reflexively saying no comment or that's not true, particularly because, and this apparently comes as a shock to some people, we did conduct surveillance, both on hardened adversaries and sometimes on our friends. We knew they collected on us, too, as that's what sovereign nations do to protect themselves and their interests. As the summer wore on, I became fond of quoting Captain Renault from the movie Casablanca, where he walks into the casino and declares, "I'm shocked, shocked to find that gambling is going on in here." Yes, we were spying, but we were complying with U.S. law, with the full visibility of all of our oversight entities. Through July and the first part of August, we worked through how we would be transparent about the matters we could be transparent about, and how we'd protect our sources and methods in a more targeted way. On August 9th, President Obama announced at a White House press conference the four steps we were taking to strike the right balance between protecting our security and preserving our freedoms. First, he called for reforms to Section 215 of the Patriot Act, explaining, "This program is an important tool in our effort to disrupt terrorist plots, and it does not allow the government to listen to any phone calls without a warrant. But given the scale of this program, I understand the concerns of those who would worry that it could be subject to abuse." Second, he promised to work with Congress to improve the public's confidence in the oversight conducted by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Third, he called for more transparency, saying, "I've directed the intelligence community to make public as much information about these programs as possible. We've already declassified unprecedented information about the NSA, but we can go further." At the end of this set of initiatives, he noted, "The intelligence community is creating a website that will serve as a hub for further transparency. And this will give Americans and the world the ability to learn more about what our intelligence community does and what it doesn't do, how it carries out its mission, and why it does so." His fourth announcement, forming a high-level group of outside experts to review our entire intelligence and communications technologies, went almost unheard in DNI's public affairs office as our social media manager, Michael Thomas, realized the president had just announced live on national television the Tumblr site he was in the process of building. He gaped at the TV screen as Public Affairs Director Sean Turner patted him on the back, asking, "So how's that website coming?" We launched the Tumblr site, IC on the Record, on August 21st, and by the end of September had declassified and published 1,800 pages of FISA court opinions. This wasn't simply a pile of unclassified documents we'd been sitting on, or a collection of improperly overclassified papers, but actual classified court opinions, including requests for surveillance warrants. We knew our adversaries would see them, and that making them public to some degree posed a risk to national security. But we judged that if we didn't take drastic steps like this, national security could be undermined more by the erosion of trust of the American public and its elected representatives. The site went on to become a clearinghouse for all the agencies to publish declassified documents and to show whatever work they were doing that they could discuss, specifically that of our oversight committees and courts. Much of the success of that website is the result of a decision we made in late June that we weren't going to release only documents that made us look good. Many of the first court opinions we published were highly critical of our surveillance requests, forcing the IC to reconsider or significantly revise warrants before they'd issue them. A year and a half later, Tumblr featured the IC's site as one of the select few Big in 2014 websites in their annual review. Michael Thomas noted that we were right up there with Lil Bub, which led me to publicly observe what an honor it was for me personally to share the stage with a famous internet cat. That's how you know you've arrived. On August 21st, as we were still scrambling to deal with the intelligence leaks, we obtained evidence that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government had launched rocket shells loaded with the chemical weapon sarin gas into the Damascus suburb of Ghouta, a community where some people had expressed support for the opposition. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of civilians, many of them children, had died horrifically. Assad had learned from the mistakes that led to Gaddafi's downfall and was keeping dissent in Syria in check with brutal force, in violation of international law and all standards of human decency. The intelligence community's response reflected lessons we'd learned in the decades since the Iraq WMD National Intelligence Estimate. We red-teamed the evidence, questioning our assumptions and assessing the limits of our analysis. When we presented our assessment, we clearly stated our confidence levels. We gave alternate explanations and highlighted the things we didn't know. All the contributing ints, SIGINT, GEOINT, HUMINT, and open source, were validated and cross-checked. Our assessment differed from the Iraq WMD report in another significant way. In 2003, the IC seemingly succumbed to pressure from the White House to find evidence of chemical and biological weapons sites. Because President Obama had previously declared that any use of chemical weapons would warrant U.S. military action, in 2013, the White House would much rather we not announce we had proof that Assad and Syria had crossed President Obama's famous red line. National Security Advisor Tom Donilon seemed to keep raising the evidentiary bar we needed to meet before he believed our reports, and we kept meeting each new challenge until I finally told his deputy, Dennis McDonough, in a sidebar meeting at a Principals Committee meeting, that we could no longer avoid telling Congress about what had become an elephant in the living room. Everyone, Congress and even the UN, found our evidence to be compelling. Foreign ambassadors who were in attendance at Colin Powell's 2003 speech on WMDs in Iraq told our analysts that the information the IC made available on Syria, the degree of transparency we afforded the international community, and our candor regarding the limitations of our data far exceeded what was provided in the run-up to Iraq. At a Friday evening National Security Council meeting, DOD laid out the plans for a Tomahawk land attack missile attack on Syria. When the meeting broke, the president went for a walk around the White House grounds, asking Dennis to join him. That evening, I got a call that President Obama would not order the attack without congressional authorization. I was surprised, but again, it wasn't my place to agonize over such policy decisions, which are ultimately the president's to make. His decision was widely panned by all sides, but cooler heads prevailed and diplomacy accomplished what a TLAM strike could not. As the flood of leaks continued, I began to worry that sources and methods we might need for the next crisis were being exposed. In Snowden's initial interviews, he'd said he'd personally reviewed all of the documents he was giving to the reporters, and that they would only expose NSA abuses of Americans' civil liberties. He then amended that to extend to the privacy rights of the world's citizens. He finally acknowledged that the scope of the material he'd leaked went beyond those parameters, but repeated he'd personally reviewed them all to make sure no sources would be revealed that would compromise U.S. security. It says a lot about Snowden that he thought he knew enough about how sources and methods were being used across the community that he could unilaterally decide what exposures would or wouldn't cause damage. On August 29th, the Washington Post published an article and leaked document that demonstrated Snowden had not in fact made an effort to protect intelligence sources. The Post, to its credit, called ahead of publication to inform us that they had the entire 2013 IC Congressional Budget Justification Book. As I've explained, the CBJB is the annual report to Congress that describes in detail the full extent of intelligence capabilities, essentially detailing what we'd done with the money that had been allocated to us and justifying our requests for the following year. It went into specifics about many programs, how they worked, what results they produced, and the effect they had on national security. It covered how we protected our forces from insurgent attacks, and how we assessed adversarial leaders' intentions. It explained how we monitored proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, including in Iran, North Korea, and Syria. It contained, in short, the full expanse of how the U.S. conducts intelligence. The Post contacted my office, they explained, because they intended to publish this document and wanted to confirm that it would not cause grave damage to national security. In the conversations that followed, I learned that the editors at the paper had a very different understanding of grave damage to national security than the practitioners of national security did. Their focus was short-term and tactical. Ours was long-term and strategic. While they didn't want to release material that might directly and immediately result in someone's death, They didn't seem concerned about exposing programs that would cause us to lose our ability to collect and exploit intelligence over the long term. After a short negotiation, which mostly involved my pleading from the national security perspective, the Post published most of the CBJB. The accompanying article included subheadings including high-tech surveillance, counterintelligence, and critical gaps, areas we'd identified to Congress as being where our collection capabilities were lacking and where adversaries could operate with little opposition. Snowden now changed his story yet again, saying that he'd given materials he knew could be damaging to reporters, not to WikiLeaks, because he trusted that as journalists, they'd serve as curators and would release only information that related to civil liberties and not that involved security functions. The Post's publication of the CBJB revealed just how naive that notion was, if he ever actually believed it. Months later, in January, the New York Times, with which The Guardian had decided to partner, displayed another way in which trusting journalists to protect secrets was naive. The Times published a story with a highly classified document that they'd redacted to protect the names of human sources in Iraq and the method we used to surveil Al-Qaeda in Mosul, the group that would become the Islamic State. The problem was that the Times did such an amateurish job of redaction that the Internet very quickly figured out the actual names and the technical methods. I can't reveal what happened to the human sources, but that method of surveillance was gone to us. There were many losses we never publicly acknowledged, but I want to point out a particularly important one. In February 2014, Glenn Greenwald started his own online publication, The Intercept, to capitalize on the Snowden leaks. That spring, The Intercept staff called to say they were working on an article about how the United States was sweeping up every cell phone call in two nations, the Bahamas and Afghanistan. We asked them not to publish either, but gave them a compelling enough reason to not release the Afghanistan information. On May 19th, The Intercept published Data Pirates of the Caribbean, which merely mentioned that there was another country in which all cell calls were being collected. Almost immediately, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks announced they knew what the other country was and demanded that The Intercept divulge its name. When Greenwald refused, Assange published through WikiLeaks on May 23rd that the second country was Afghanistan. At the time, I couldn't reveal what program we'd lost as a result. But in September 2015, I declassified it and said in a public speech that what they'd exposed was what the U.S. command in Afghanistan regarded as the single most important source of force protection and warning for our people there. Specifically, I explained that it provided warning of impending IED attacks, and the day after he wrote about it, the program was shut down by the government of Afghanistan. Intelligence losses are typically experienced as second- and third-order effects, such as an intelligence gap that didn't enable us to put two pieces of information together. The loss of the Afghan program had more immediate consequences. Those first few months of leaks, June through September, were among the most difficult of my career. Not only were we witnessing our intelligence advantage erode and losing valuable sources, but we were also being vilified by the press and experiencing the people we served turn on us. In the meantime, sequestration was not only eroding our capabilities, but restricting us from using funds in ways that might have helped blunt the damage from Snowden. At the same time, nations we considered our friends were concerned that we were spying on their citizens, which we weren't, and our closest intelligence partners were questioning whether we could still be trusted with their secrets, or if more Snowdens were poised to expose their activities to the world. By the end of the summer, the companies we'd relied on for help, particularly in telecommunications, had decided that no matter how dire the situation was, they had to make a choice between patriotic duty and what would happen to their bottom line if customers believed their data or conversations were no longer secure, an issue some believed impacted the viability of their company. As the cherry on top of this misery Sunday, Congress failed to pass either an Appropriations Act or continuing resolution, and the government shut down from October 1st through October 16th, 2013. Our non-essential employees were sent home, and our essential employees worked without pay. Through all of those tribulations, I'm proud of how the IC responded with creative solutions to keep programs functioning and to quickly fill gaps by pivoting collection platforms whenever a publication exposed our capabilities. Agencies admitted their losses and looked to one another for help filling intelligence gaps. At the same time, our counterintelligence and security professionals put new procedures and online programs in place intended to thwart other potential leakers and to detect any attempts to repeat what Snowden had done. Finally, the people of the IC also opened their files and vaults to a review of their work, including by Congress and by a team appointed by the President. My greatest personal disappointment through all this was that my exchange with Senator Wyden in the March testimony continued to be a distraction, one we apparently could not move beyond. On December 19th, seven Republicans from the House Judiciary Committee, James Sensenbrenner, Daryl Issa, Trent Franks, Raul Labrador, Ted Poe, Trey Gowdy, and Blake Farenthold, wrote to Attorney General Eric Holder, demanding that he investigate me for knowingly and willfully lying to Congress under oath. When I spoke to Eric about the letter, he dismissed it as frivolous and political, and I responded that I thought he should take them up on their request. Having been convicted in the court of public opinion, I would have preferred a formal investigation rather than dealing with the accusations and innuendos of reporters selling papers and politicians making political hay. Eric said he didn't want to dignify their allegations. I always thought it telling that the Senate Intelligence Committee itself never saw fit to make a referral to the Justice Department. On January 17, 2014, President Obama addressed the nation to discuss the results of the intelligence community review he'd ordered and some changes he was making. I was in the audience in the auditorium at the Justice Department, a location specifically chosen to emphasize the importance of oversight and the rule of law. When the president both delivered a rousing defense of the intelligence community and described specific steps for reforming how we did business aimed at regaining the trust of the American public, he began by saying that he'd come into the office skeptical of intelligence overreach, and as president, he'd put additional protections and oversight procedures on programs that could feasibly be abused. But he clarified, "What I did not do is stop these programs wholesale, not only because I felt that they made us more secure, but also because nothing in that initial review and nothing that I have learned since indicated that our intelligence community has sought to violate the law or is cavalier about the civil liberties of their fellow citizens. To the contrary, in an extraordinarily difficult job, one in which actions are second-guessed, success is unreported, and failure can be catastrophic, the men and women of the intelligence community, including the NSA, consistently follow protocols designed to protect the privacy of ordinary people. They're not abusing authorities in order to listen to your private phone calls or read your emails. When mistakes are made, which is inevitable in any large and complicated human enterprise, they correct those mistakes, laboring in obscurity, often unable to discuss their work even with family and friends." I later said publicly that President Obama understood where his intelligence came from better than any of his recent predecessors, even George H.W. Bush, who had served as CIA director for almost a year. I just wished he'd gained that understanding for a better reason. The president continued, "If any individual who objects to government policy can take it into their own hands to publicly disclose classified information, then we will not be able to keep our people safe or conduct foreign policy. Moreover, the sensational way in which these disclosures have come out has often shed more heat than light, while revealing methods to our adversaries that could impact our operations in ways that we might not fully understand for years to come." He said that, "Regardless of how we got here, though, we had serious work ahead of us to protect ourselves and sustain our leadership in the world while upholding the civil liberties and privacy protections our ideals and our Constitution require. He laid out a series of major reforms in quick succession. First was a new presidential directive for our signals intelligence activities both at home and abroad, which in many ways provided that we treat ordinary foreign citizens with the same protections we had for Americans, something no other nation on earth would consider. Second was putting concrete programs in place to provide greater transparency to our surveillance activities and fortify the safeguards that protect the privacy of U.S. persons, particularly regarding the Section 702 Foreign Intelligence Program and the Section 215 Metadata Program. Third, he asked the Attorney General and me to place additional restrictions on government's ability to retain, search, and use in criminal cases communications between Americans and foreign citizens incidentally collected under Section 702. Fourth, he placed time limits on the secrecy of court warrants known as national security letters, under which a suspected terrorist or foreign spy is investigated or surveilled without being notified. Fifth and last, he addressed the controversial Section 215, beginning with why it had come into existence, after one of the 9/11 hijackers, Khalid al-Midar, made a phone call from San Diego to a known al-Qaeda safe house in Yemen. NSA saw that call, but it could not see that the call was coming from an individual already in the United States. He noted that his review group turned up no indication that this database has been intentionally abused, but that he believed critics are right to point out that without proper safeguards, this type of program could be used to yield more information about our private lives, and that while the courts and Congress did exert oversight, it has never been subject to vigorous public debate. He then made an announcement that shocked many people. For all these reasons, I believe we need a new approach. I am therefore ordering a transition that will end the Section 215 bulk metadata program as it currently exists and establish a mechanism that preserves the capabilities we need without the government holding this bulk metadata. The new program, embodied in the USA Freedom Act, took another year and a half to pass Congress, but it required telecommunications companies to hold their own data and the IC to obtain a warrant referencing a specific threat in order to be able to access the company's records. In practice, this wasn't significantly different from what we'd been doing, but people seemed to trust the commercial providers holding and protecting their data more than they trusted the U.S. government to do so. President Obama concluded his speech with this thought. It may seem sometimes that America is being held to a different standard, and I'll admit the readiness of some to assume the worst motives by our government can be frustrating. No one expects China to have an open debate about their surveillance programs or Russia to take privacy concerns of citizens in other places into account. But let's remember we are held to a different standard, precisely because we have been at the forefront of defending personal privacy and human dignity. As the nation that developed the Internet, the world expects us to ensure that the digital revolution works as a tool for individual empowerment, not government control. Having faced down the dangers of totalitarianism and fascism and communism, the world expects us to stand up for the principle that every person has the right to think and write and form relationships freely, because individual freedom is the wellspring of human progress. 6 days later, the German TV network ARD interviewed Snowden, who was, unsurprisingly, unimpressed with the president's speech and the new initiatives. I didn't watch the interview when it aired, but some colleagues clipped one specific question and answer and sent it to me. The interviewer asked Snowden, "You were working until last summer for the NSA, and during this time you secretly collected thousands of confidential documents. What was the decisive moment, or was there a long period of time or something happening? Why did you do this?" Snowden replied, "I would say sort of the breaking point is seeing the Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, directly lie under oath to Congress. I was, to say the least, incredulous at the level of cognitive dissonance it must have taken for him to give that answer. Snowden had been stealing U.S. intelligence secrets, copying them and removing them from secured spaces, for a full year by the time I testified in March 2013. 4.5 months before my testimony, he had contacted Glenn Greenwald and offered these classified documents, and by the time I'd testified, he'd already leaked them to Greenwald and Laura Poitras through encrypted emails, as well as contacted Bart Gellman, offering to leak to the Washington Post. When my friend Locke Johnson, whom I'd known since we attended high school together in Germany, and who had been a staff member on the Church Committee when they'd investigated intelligence abuses in the 1970s, invited me to the University of Georgia that April to make up the charter lecture that I'd been forced to cancel because of the shutdown in October, I knew I would have to address Snowden to the student body. In my speech, I talked to them about politics in Washington and how we don't always follow ancient tribal wisdom about dismounting dead horses. I talked about the vast array of threats we faced as a nation and about the damage done by the leaks. I then spoke about how what Snowden had done affected me personally, which I hadn't done before publicly. A few weeks ago, I saw an article in the Washington Post detailing college admissions. An admissions officer from George Washington University told the Post that for the admissions essay question, "Who's your personal hero?" This is a quote. She's seeing a lot of Edward Snowden citations. The idea that young people see Edward Snowden as a hero really bothers me. So I felt that I needed to talk about Snowden here. First off, I get it. I understand that some people see Snowden as a courageous whistleblower standing up to authority. I personally believe that whistleblowing takes an incredible amount of courage and integrity. But Snowden isn't a whistleblower. Of course, by April 2014, most government executives were comfortable with saying that Edward Snowden wasn't a whistleblower. We'd pointed out how Snowden had failed to use the legitimate whistleblowing avenues open to him. Senior officers at NSA, criminal investigation units, NSAs or the IC's Inspector General, the Civil Liberties Protection Officer in my office, the Justice Department, or Congress. We had also laid out how irresponsible he'd been with releasing hundreds of thousands of documents relating to the full spectrum of lawful intelligence activities all over the world. But I understood that it was very easy to talk about what someone has done wrong, to tell people what they shouldn't do, and whom they shouldn't emulate. It's more of a challenge to point out examples they should look up to and emulate. We couldn't expect the next generation of selfless, patriotic young people to join the intelligence community if our pitch was going to be, "Come here and don't be like Edward Snowden." I wanted to offer the students at UGA something different. If you want a whistleblowing role model, look at Sergeant Joe Darby. He was an Army reservist stationed at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq in 2003. One afternoon, one of the prison guards handed him a CD. Joe stuck the disc into his computer and was shocked when he saw graphic images of guards abusing prisoners. Those guards were friends of his, some since high school. He agonized thinking of his friends and his superiors, whom he'd be implicating, and he worried that those people could come after him for retribution. It took him 3 weeks of torment before he turned the disc over to a special agent with the Army Criminal Investigation Command. You know about the global uproar when the pictures went public. For Joe, it was more personal. His fellow soldiers at Abu Ghraib shook his hand and thanked him. But back home, people called him a traitor and threatened his life. The Army needed to give his family an armed escort for 6 months. That act of whistleblowing took courage and integrity. In 2007, Joe Darby told the BBC, "I've never regretted for one second what I did when I was in Iraq to turn those pictures in." I think he makes a great role model. I'd like to read an admissions essay on him. And I want people working for me who have the same sense of right and wrong, and the courage and integrity to speak up. I then introduced Sean Curran, a University of Georgia graduate with a double major in mathematics and geology, who was now working for DOD, helping develop the cryptanalytic capabilities the IC relies on for its foreign intelligence mission. Before turning the microphone over to Sean to talk about his experience, I gave the students a recruiting pitch. We need people with the talent and dedication of Sean Curran in the IC, and we absolutely welcome people with the courage and integrity of Joe Darby. Being an intelligence officer means that sometimes you are the most junior person in the room, and you still have to voice an unpopular truth, to speak truth to power. Because at the end of the day, it's our job to give useful intelligence to decision makers and policy makers, not just to tell them what they want to hear. I think most of you really would like working in intelligence, but if that's not your cup of tea, I hope you can serve our country in some other way, at least for a few years. We need bright young men and women like you everywhere in government. Serving is better than making a ton of money or skating through a life of leisure. It really is. And I do believe that so many of you already know that. Chapter 9. Not a Diplomat. When I went back to Capitol Hill in January and February to present the IC's 2014 Worldwide Threat Assessment, I felt like a man who had traversed mountains and rivers through hostile territory only to find himself back at the spot where he'd started, now surrounded by adversaries on all sides. In less than a year, we'd lost some of our most important intelligence collection capabilities to a traitor from within our own ranks. We'd lost much of our capacity to replace those capabilities due to sequestration cuts, along with shedding thousands of contractors we could no longer afford to pay. We'd lost access to a lot of telecommunications information, as many companies resisted helping us, sometimes even with active terrorist investigations. We'd lost the trust of some foreign governments, which were truly surprised we were surveilling them, not to mention many more who feigned surprise, because, as we both knew, they were also surveilling us. We'd lost the trust of some foreign intelligence partners who questioned our ability to keep their secrets as they lost their own capabilities to Snowden's leaks. And, most disturbing, we'd lost the trust of the American public, which questioned what we were doing globally on their behalf and what we were doing domestically to them. We were being far more transparent than I would have imagined possible just a few years earlier, but it felt as though we had barely made a dent in dampening the public anger. Also, as I sat for the 2014 hearings, I felt a new personal antagonism for some congressional members, which had nothing to do with performing for the red light over the camera. Attorney General Holder had not answered the House Judiciary Committee's request to investigate me in December, and he had not replied to their follow-up letter in January asking why he hadn't begun an investigation. I hadn't done myself any favors, repeatedly trying to oversimplify an explanation for my mistake into something that could be expressed in a soundbite. That was particularly true of an interview with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell just days after the Snowden leak, when I tried to explain what I'd been thinking when answering Senator Wyden's yes or no question months earlier, which I'd misunderstood at the time he asked it. I still couldn't clarify what my answer should have been for Mitchell, as the Section 215 program was still classified, even after being leaked. On camera, I told her something incomprehensible about no being the least untruthful of the two answers I could give. My statement had been widely recognized as the best Washington doublespeak of that month and had earned me the Washington Post's Worst Week in Washington Award on June 14th. Whatever else happened, there was no way to get that moment back. I'd sent an email to Dennis McDonough offering to resign. I will never forget Dennis and his perceptive and compassionate leadership. He called me less than 15 minutes later to say my resignation was not accepted and to tell me to focus on my duties. This, I came to learn when Dennis became chief of staff, was typical of him. For the rest of the administration, I witnessed countless examples of Dennis reaching out to people at just the right time, with just the right dose of encouragement. 6 months after receiving Dennis's timely support, continuing my duties meant going to the Hill again. Complicating the 2014 hearings, just before I briefed our threat assessment to the House Intelligence Committee on February 4th, President Obama gave an interview with CNN in which Jake Tapper asked him about my exchange with Senator Wyden and my least untruthful answer to Andrea Mitchell. The president responded, "I think that Jim Clapper himself would acknowledge, and has acknowledged, that he should have been more careful about how he responded. His concern was that he had a classified program that he couldn't talk about, and he was in an open hearing in which he was asked, he was prompted to disclose, a program, and so he felt that he was caught between a rock and a hard place. Subsequently, I think he's acknowledged that he could have handled it better. He's spoken to Mr. Wyden personally." His answer was an attempt to paint what had happened in a constructive light and move on, and I might have been okay with it had the president or I ever spoken directly about my exchange with Wyden. We had discussed and moved past other questionable comments I'd made in hearings, as well as my London gaffe with Diane Sawyer, but we never talked about this one. After the Tapper interview, I remarked privately to a group that included USDI Mike Vickers that since I was so far under the bus, I might as well change the oil while I'm down here. Later, I learned that Mike never forgets anything. If appearing publicly on Capitol Hill felt like walking into a field of fire, to borrow an army expression I'd learned in South Korea, the situation in no way affected my obligation to speak intelligence truth to power, and I had no intention of being cautious or taking a diplomatic course with Congress. So to the great distress of the National Intelligence Council, instead of having them write the first draft of my opening statement, I wrote it myself, broad-brushing the threats around the globe and focusing on how leaks and sequestration were causing us to lose our ability to collect intelligence on those threats. Long-tenured NIC Chairman Chris Kojum urged me to take a more traditional approach, and I eventually gave in to his argument that Congress and the public deserved to hear more actual details of the threat picture, and I let the senior analysts on the National Intelligence Council edit and expand the opening statement. Still, parts of my first draft survived, including referring during the February 11th hearing with the Senate Armed Services Committee to the confluence of sequestration, leaks, and loss of partnerships as the perfect storm. I told them that we would, as always, meet the threat to the best of our abilities, but sequestration, with its drastic cuts and arcane rules, was a self-imposed handicap, forcing the nation to accept more risk. After speaking truth to power on how all of this was clouding the threat picture and making the world more dangerous, I highlighted the few specific crises we considered the most pressing, one being the civil war in Syria, which by then was creating a threat to the U.S. homeland. "The strength of the insurgency is now estimated at somewhere between 75,000 to 80,000 on the low end and 110,000 to 115,000 on the high end, who are organized into more than 1,500 groups of widely varying political leanings. Three of the most effective are the Al-Nusra Front, Ahrar al-Sham, and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, as it's known, whose numbers total more than 20,000. Complicating this further are the 7,500-plus foreign fighters from some 50 countries who have gravitated to Syria." Unlike in Libya in 2012, there was no unified resistance in Syria. And despite what Senator McCain had said in 2013, we had a very difficult time identifying the good guys. Mixed in throughout the Syrian resistance were al-Qaeda operatives and Iraq insurgency veterans, all of whom hated America. Our biggest concern was that eventually the fighters who had traveled from abroad, particularly those coming from Europe, but a growing number from the United States, would return home having been radicalized by the terrorists they were fighting alongside, and having learned new skills in war they could now apply against their fellow Europeans or Americans. Adding to this nightmare, refugees were pouring across Syria's borders, and its border with Iraq was merely notional. There was very little stopping transit between the two countries, as we saw when the Islamic State of Iraq changed its name to include both Iraq and Syria, the Levant, as its territory. The one piece of positive news in Syria was that after the U.S. intelligence community had presented such a compelling case to show Assad's use of chemical weapons the past fall, he had admitted to having about 1,000 tons of mustard gas, sarin, and the nerve agent VX, and an international team had destroyed the equipment for producing the chemicals. By February, they were well into destroying or removing Syria's existing stockpiles. It was, however, difficult to destroy chemical weapons in a war zone, and we had no illusions that Assad couldn't reconstitute his chemical weapons program quickly if he decided to. At the hearings, I continued my tradition of adding a year to the count of how we were facing the most diverse set of threats I'd seen in my now more than 5 decades in the intelligence business. In the televised SASC hearing, I cited the growth of foreign cyber capabilities, both nation-states as well as non-nation-states, the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, aggressive nation-state intelligence efforts against us, an assertive Russia, a competitive China, a dangerous, unpredictable North Korea, a challenging Iran, where the economic sanctions have had a profound impact on Iran's economy and have contributed to the P5+1 joint plan of action, lingering ethnic divisions in the Balkans, perpetual conflict and extremism in Africa, in Mali, Nigeria, Central African Republic, and South Sudan, violent political struggles in, among others, the Ukraine, Burma, Thailand, and Bangladesh, the specter of mass atrocities, the increasing stress of burgeoning populations, the urgent demands for energy, water, and food, the increasing sophistication of transnational crime, the tragedy and magnitude of human trafficking, the insidious rot of inventive synthetic drugs, the potential for pandemic disease occasioned by the growth of drug-resistant bacteria. I could go on with this litany, I said, looking up from the script, but suffice it to say we live in a complex, dangerous world. The events of the past year had made the world so much harder to keep track of, and not just because some of our capabilities had been compromised. No matter how good they were, imagery and signals intelligence would only get us so far in understanding the reality on the ground in the far-flung areas of the world, and CIA had only so many operatives in a relatively limited number of places. To assess the situation in a remote nation in Africa or island in South Asia, we relied on the governments and intelligence services of the regional powers that were invested there. Over the past 8 months, I'd spent a lot of time on secure, long-distance calls and traveled many thousands of miles trying to repair and restore those relationships. In November, I'd been to Europe and Asia, and was soon scheduled for a trip to Norway and Sweden, and then to meet with our close Five Eyes English-speaking partners, the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Overseas travel was not glamorous. I flew with my executive assistant, 1 or 2 subject matter experts, the 3-star general who led ODNI's partner engagement, successively Mike Flynn, Ted Nicholas, and then John Bansomer, and a travel coordinator, along with the air crew, security, protective detail, and communications teams, on a large Air Force transport plane inside a secure box with no windows. In whatever country we'd landed, we'd ride to a hotel in a caravan of SUVs, typically eat dinner with our hosts, and prep for the next day, which would be filled with meetings, both with foreign government counterparts and with the U.S. intelligence officers stationed there. We packed as much personal interface time into these trips as possible, typically across a conference table, never a putting green. At meetings of the Five Eyes partners, which we held twice a year and rotated among each of the five nations, we dwelled on how we could collectively mitigate the damage we were all incurring from the publication of the leaks. Those were the serious discussions. During breaks, all four of the other national intelligence leaders took turns, and great joy in asking pointed questions about our American political processes. Sequestration and debt ceilings. We don't have those. What are they like? And so tell me again about how the greatest democracy on earth works. More than once, the United Kingdom's intelligence chief observed that it had been a grave mistake for the United States to declare independence, but that Queen Elizabeth was willing to welcome us back into her good graces once we were willing to admit our error. I never was able to come up with an appropriately witty retort. Our mutual challenge had drawn us closer than ever, and a year later, I would publicly make the seemingly outlandish to the arch-conservatives in the USIC suggestion that dual citizenship privileges and obligation should be extended to all the Five Eyes partners whenever we found ourselves in one another's intelligence footprint with full access to each nation's networks. This is an idea whose time hadn't come before I retired, but I'm convinced it will happen someday. For most of the other parties mentioned in the Snowden leaks, I'd developed a script for how to get past the awkward first few minutes of our meetings. The delegation leader would start with some version of, "We've read all the shocking media reporting about your collection on our government through NSA's capabilities." Without acknowledging the specific allegation, I'd respond, "The president has tasked us to study this with an intent to reform how we conduct intelligence." We would all nod and then get on with business, leaving unspoken any understanding of how their intelligence services were spying on us. Everyone wanted insight on what U.S. leaders were thinking, in general and in relation to their parochial issues and their government, and on the state of technology in America. Every national delegation I met with also needed U.S. intelligence insights, particularly on terrorist threats, to keep stability in their sector of the world. Outside the Five Eyes circle, Norway and Japan understood our mutual dependencies best and did the most to minimize damage from public discussion of the leaks and what they revealed. Not surprisingly, those two nations have moved into the next concentric circle of partnership with U.S. intelligence in the years since, to their credit and to our mutual benefit. I can say, however, that without a doubt, the 2014 bilateral meeting I had with a delegation from Brazil, the nation where Glenn Greenwald kept his residence, was one of the ugliest and nastiest of my 53-year-long career. Most nations sent their intelligence leaders to these gatherings. Some, to make a point, sent their diplomats. Brazil sent its attorneys. President Dilma Rousseff was furious with the United States for purportedly spying on her, her government, and her citizens, at least according to Greenwald, and so dispatched her lead attack dog, Antonio Patriota, who had once been Brazil's ambassador to the United Nations and was specifically named by Greenwald as someone we'd surveilled. He was backed up by a large contingent from Brazil's Ministry of Justice. Without exchanging pleasantries, Patriota began reading aloud 28 pejorative questions, charges, really, that he demanded the United States answer. Each was intentionally insulting either to the United States or to the U.S. intelligence community. I sat and listened, and when he was halfway through his list, I politely interrupted and asked if he would give me a copy of it so we could provide him with formal interagency coordinated responses. That only seemed to infuriate him more, as my attempt to cooperate had broken his rhythm. But even that enmity was short-lived. 2 years later, Brazil hosted the 2016 Summer Olympics, and the U.S. intelligence community supported their efforts in a major way, deploying people and teams from several IC components. We provided them with intelligence that was not only timely enough for them to act, but was specific enough for them to make preemptive arrests. There were no attacks on any Olympic venue or event. debriefing the success of the Olympics in 2016 after Rousseff's exit, I recounted for the DNI representative in Brazil what had occurred with Antonio Patriota in 2014. He suggested it would be an opportune time to visit Brazil, and I did. That was one of the most pleasant and most productive foreign trips I ever took. Another key